Thanks, 10-4.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. You're tuned to This Week in Radio News. This is Tom Rowe with the radio news about radio waves. John Anderson in DIYmedia.net reports that the National Association of Broadcasters are currently lobbying the Federal Communications Commission hard to allow AM radio stations to acquire FM translators. The FCC is considering ways to revitalize the AM band, and apparently, the commercial radio industry thinks broadcasting on FM frequencies is the best method to fix AM radio. So far, the FCC has been resistant to allowing AM stations to rebroadcast their same signals on FM translator stations, keeping those frequencies for stations creating original content. Quote, in the last month, a motley crew of advocates for more FM translators have been making the rounds at FCC headquarters. These include trade groups, individual broadcasters, and other interested parties, unquote, Anderson writes, saying that existing translators have been priced out of reach for small broadcasters who want a new translator filing window exclusively for AM broadcasters. But Anderson also points out that the industry is not offering any prohibitions on AM stations selling any valuable translator permits that would result from a new filing window. Read the full story at DIYmedia.net, and full disclosure, John Anderson is on Wavefarm's board.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else.
Eric Gardner in The Hollywood Reporter writes that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, September 14th, ruled that copyright owners must consider fair use before sending internet takedown letters. The case revolved around a YouTube video of a toddler dancing to a 29-second clip from Prince's Let's Go Crazy song. Wikipedia says fair use is, quote, a doctrine that permits limited use of copyrighted material without acquiring permission from the rights holders, unquote. Circuit Judge Richard Tallman wrote in this decision, quote, even if, as Universal urges, fair use is classified as an affirmative defense, we hold, for the purposes of the DMCA, fair use is uniquely situated in copyright law so as to be treated differently from traditional affirmative defenses. We conclude that because Statute 17 U.S.C. 107 created a type of non-infringing use, fair use is, quote, authorized by the law, unquote, and a copyright holder must consider the existence of fair use before sending a takedown notification under Statute 512C, unquote. But what does consider mean, and can the bots that currently send takedown notices on copyright issues consider fair use? Quote, to be clear, if a copyright holder ignores or neglects our unequivocal holding that it must consider fair use before sending a takedown notification, it is liable for damages under Section 512F, unquote, writes Tallman. Quote, if, however, a copyright holder forms a subjective good faith belief the allegedly infringing material does not constitute fair use, we are in no position to dispute the copyright holder's belief, even if we would have reached the opposite conclusion, unquote, writes Tallman, who says juries will decide those questions, and a jury will decide the baby dancing to Prince issue in a new trial. Brian Palmer in On Earth magazine reports that the U.S. Navy has agreed to reduce sonar sounds in the Pacific Ocean that have been bombarding whales and dolphins with noise. Since 2003, activists have been winning in court efforts to quiet the intense high-volume sounds that can travel hundreds of miles in water. Last weekend, the Natural Resources Defense Council and the U.S. Navy reached a federal court agreement with the Navy silencing its sonar in areas around Southern California and Hawaii during certain periods of the year when marine mammal populations are most vulnerable. The agreement runs until the end of 2018, and at that point, the U.S. National Marine Fisheries Service should issue new environmental impact statements and authorizations regarding military exercises. Activists claim mass strandings of large marine animals sometimes coincide with nearby naval deployments. The noise is so loud, whales will do anything to avoid it, leaving the water, the theory goes. The Navy told the judge during the proceedings that the proposed closures would hamper its, quote, ability to adapt training, unquote, and, quote, evolve as the threat emerges, unquote. U.S. District Court Judge Susan Okemawe described the national security warnings as, quote, pure hyperbole, unquote. The NRDC says it will challenge sonar use in the Navy's other training areas off the Pacific Northwest, in the Gulf of Alaska, and off northern Florida. Have you heard this song before? Probably have heard that song before. Jason Mick at DailyTech.com reports that the makers of the Piracy It's a Crime commercials used that song from Dutch musician Melcher Rietveld's on that project, the Piracy It's a Crime commercial, and on many others, putting it in over 71 DVDs and pre-movie ads all over the world. Rietveld discovered the piracy watching a Harry Potter DVD with a pre-ad that included his song. So he called Buma Stemra, the agency he had worked with in 2006 on a project with that song. They promised to send him a list of all the instances the song had been used and an advance of about $17,000, but never sent any accounting of the use. Then he recorded Burma Stemra board member Joachim Gerrits telling him if he wanted to get paid, he should sign with Mr. Gerrits' label, High Fashion Music, where Gerrits would take 33% of Rietveld's royalties. When that was revealed publicly, Burma Stemra sent him another $35,000, and last week, a court ordered another $68,000 plus legal fees and a fine of $22,000 against the company to go to promote artist awareness of collecting royalties. Kunstradio added a memoriam page for co-founder Robert Adrian on September 10th. Here is the message. Robert Adrian was born in Toronto, Canada on February 22, 1935, and lived in Vienna since 1972. The visual artist and pioneer of telecommunication art passed away on Monday, September 7, 2015. It is not only the international telecommunication projects he has conceived, for instance, The World in 24 Hours from 1982 and Vancouver 4 from 1983, or the absurdly easy accessibility, at least on the simplest level, of his pictures, sculptures of poor materials that has made Robert Adrian an important model for many artists, particularly of the younger generations. It is above all his theoretically founded way of working, of engaging in constructive, collaborative, and discussions. Kunstradio was established in 1987 and took its name from Kunstfunk project, organized by the artist Blix, which included Robert Adrian, Helmut Mark, Zelko Wiener. This network project had its headquarters in the Vienna Secession, not only resulted from the collaboration with international artists, but also was created together with radio amateurs who brought their satellite Oscar into the network. Not least through this collaboration with artists who participated in or were influenced by early telecommunication projects, Kunstradio was able to contribute on an international level to the new definition of radio art in the 90s, and it has also come up with a number of other innovative projects. Adrian was also responsible for the Kunstradio homepage, which went online in April 1995. Go to the Kunstradio website for more information. All right, so we are speaking with Mendy and Keith Obadicki, whose show Number Station Furtive Movements is from September 10th through October 10th at the Ryan Lee Gallery in New York. Is that right?
That's right. Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about the show?
Yeah, so the piece is a sound installation. and sort of a micro radio station in the gallery. And for this piece, we're using stop and frisk data, sort of self-reported data from the NYPD.
Mm-hmm. And so we're using the idea of a number station, which is a kind of station that you might hear anywhere in the world. With they're called number stations, but some of them are numbers, some of them are other strange sounds, and they live in this place between electronic music and spy communications. So we're using the idea of number station as a kind of form for our piece that uses the data from Stop and Frisk.
And I guess the numbers are kind of different here, or are they similar? Is it a kind of a code for? Are the numbers released by the police department sort of a code for something else? Is that a...
Well, I mean, the numbers reported by the police department are, very literal. I mean, they are numbering the number of stops and frisks that they do from each precinct. So if you can get this data from the ACLU or the NYCLU, and so they'll say, precinct number one, for this quarter of the year, they stopped, 134 people, right? And so we're taking that number submitted by the precinct and we're turning that into sound. So if that precinct stopped 134 people, then we make that into 134 hertz. And so that's how we're generating sound from this sort of self-reported data. Now, in the original number station, yes, you're right. I mean, they are broadcasting code that is sort of decoded on the other end somehow. Our information is not encoded information. We're literally sort of re-performing these numbers that are part of this database.
But it is kind of a code. I mean, I guess, is it true? I think I've read that they don't collect the information about how many police officers shoot people or shoot unarmed people, and that's part of the missing data here.
Yeah. So there's no sort of recording of that information. And the other thing that's come out over the years is that these numbers, even this sort of stop and frisk data, has been sort of massaged a bit in order to make the departments look good. So sometimes they're underreporting, sometimes they're overreporting, and so you can see certain patterns across the years. And we hope that you'll be able to hear certain patterns as you listen to sort of what we're making from these reported numbers.
And as you look at as you look at the data, the numbers from precinct to precinct might vary, but just as interesting are the numbers from quarter to quarter and within the same precinct. Those numbers. We hope that you'll be able to get a sense of that range being really an interesting thing over time.
And I guess I'm not unclear on the geographical location or limitations. What are you just taking New York City numbers or certain precincts or where the gallery is located or what is the?
We're doing all of New York City.
All of the reporting, not all of the precincts report, but all of the precincts that report from New York City.
How are they allowed not to report? I mean, what sort of precincts don't report?
Well, we know the numbers that don't report. I mean, you're able to trace it, but for example, from 2003 to 2013, precinct number 121 doesn't report, but then they start to report it in 2013.
So, why that's possible?
We don't know.
We don't know. I'm not sure.
And what... what surprised you? I guess you've looked over a lot of numbers lately.
Yes,
we've looked over a lot of numbers, and so we haven't really done a thorough study of where every precinct is. But it's just astonishing to see that one precinct might stop 1,000 people in a quarter, and then the next precinct might stop 10 people.
Right. I mean, it's that different.
So those things are interesting, but as we were looking at these numbers, we're also sort of reading stories about the reporting, and so we know, for instance, that some precincts are trying to keep the numbers manageable, right? So they want a high number so they can show that they're being productive, but they don't want the number too high because they want to be able to improve on that number the next year, mm-hmm. right? And we know this because of whistleblowers. because some police officers have recorded sessions with their supervisors where they say that this kind of alteration of the numbers has been done. So for us, this is interesting since we're making sounds from this piece. It's almost like we're collaborating with these sort of creative numbers coming from the NYPD. It's like they're giving us a score and we're sort of playing the score that they've given us. But it's definitely creative work being done on both ends.
Was it difficult? I mean, you've kind of found a way to make manifest a issue that is kind of, I mean, just the numbers themselves that you can gloss over and you don't really understand by looking at rows of numbers. I guess this is more visceral that you, by hearing the thing repeated over and over again, you kind of feel the repetition or feel the problem more.
Well, yeah, I mean, we hope to make it visceral to people in a new kind of way. I mean, certainly it's shocking if you look at a report and you see, you know, 2,000 people are stopped in one quarter. But we think that it's a different kind of, you know, embodied experience when you're sort of listening to sounds go past you and all of a sudden you hear a 2 kilohertz sound. I mean, for anyone who doesn't know, that can be a kind of piercing, high-pitched sound. And so we want people to be able to feel these sort of peaks and valleys in this reporting, just as they're listening to these sounds go by them.
Have you played this for people? Have you got a reaction so far?
This is our first time showing the piece. Yeah. So you know, we've been sort of thinking about the piece for a long time and sort of collecting information for this piece, but we weren't exactly sure where, in what kind of context we were going to show the piece. I mean, we got interested in it when one of these first whistleblower stories in this time period came out in 2010. There was a police officer in Brooklyn who was sort of reporting. He was recording his supervisors because they were pressuring him to bring his numbers up, among other things. And so we got interested in the recordings then. We were interested in the numbers. But at that time, I don't think this information was widely available. And in the last couple of years, the ACLU has made it available as police brutality and stop and frisk has been more in the news. More people have had access to this information.
And it's interesting. I mean, I think those kind of stories have piqued the interest of a lot of people. And the data is interesting, but it is kind of difficult to get your head around, as you were saying, until you think about different ways of becoming aware of the differences. I mean, so that has been how we've been thinking about aesthetics and the piece, you know, how do we become aware of the range? How do we become aware of how things change over time and from place to place? And you can even, you know, without looking from precinct, you know, what this number precinct is, this place, you can kind of feel what that place is like by the numbers over time, you know, as you sit with the numbers. So that's an interesting thing that I've come to understand by trying to make my way around the data.
And it sounds like from what you said before that some people may, their personal experience, the numbers point out, may be that they don't see that there's as much of a problem with police and community relations. But a couple blocks away, there could be this artificially created situation where people's lives are being like harassed and changed drastically because of some mandate to reach certain numbers.
Yes.
It's really clear, like, you know, like there's one, I won't get into the specific numbers, but yeah, from one precinct that's in the thousands and the next one that's in the tens. I mean, you can tell that obviously something is happening, you know, to require those numbers stay high. You know, it's when you get a sense of that difference is when these numbers have meaning.
And can you give us a description of sort of how it works when somebody walks in and there'll be a continuous feed and will you be able to tell that you're talking about precinct 17 data then, or is it a big collage? That's how does it work?
So on Wednesday night, we're sort of doing a live performance of it, meaning that we're playing the sounds in real time and we're reading the precinct numbers and the reported numbers of stop and frisk for that precinct. Mm-hmm. So we're reading those in real time against these sounds, against these sign tones generated by the numbers. And after that Wednesday night performance, a recording of that will play in the gallery on a loop. And there's also a kind of low power sort of shortwave broadcast this broadcasting on 13.65 megahertz. So that's happening. It's a kind of low power thing. But yeah, so if you walk into the gallery, what you're going to hear are our voices reading numbers, and you're going to hear these sounds generated from the numbers.
And are they coming through radios, or what are the speakers?
Two speakers mounted on the wall, yes.
How does this, can you explain to listeners that may be unfamiliar with your work, how does this relate to some of your past work?
So in the past, we've done a lot of things with numbers, and we've done a lot of things with data about African American bodies. So we've done things about DNA in the past. We've done things about color coding through numbers. And this is part of a new series where we're using number stations as the form. So we're doing a series of things all using number station, where we're looking at, there's a book from the late 1800s called The Red Record by a journalist, Ida B. Wells, where she collected lynching statistics from the late 1800s. And so we're going to read the numbers from that book in a number station piece as well. That's the piece that we're going to work on after this.
I was going to say that using the sign tones related to letters or numbers, that was also another practice that we've used in the past as a part of praise songs as well. So that aesthetic form is one that's connected, and then the looking at numbers and data is another thing. So these two things come together in this piece in a new way, but it's something that we've done. All the parts of it are things that we've done in the past.
Do you call yourselves internet artists, or do you have an adjective you'd like to put in front of your work like that? Or
not usually. I mean, we work with sound a lot. We've worked online a bit. In many ways, sound and music are kind of through line for the project, but usually we just say we're artists, you know.
And of course, music is all numbers, basically, and the internet is all zeros and ones, I guess, too, right?
Yeah. So it's all data.
And where can people find information about this show?
You can find information. You can go to the Ryan Lee Gallery website, or you can go to our website, obadike.com. Our last name is OBADIKE. You can go there. You can find Mindy and Keith on Facebook.
Yeah.
MENDIKEITH.
And it looks like RyanLeeGallery.com also has information about the particular show that is September 10th through October 10th. And we're talking to Mindy and Keith Obadike. The show is called Number Station Furtive Movements. What does furtive movements refer to?
So furtive movements is one way police officers have justified stopping people, right? So if you move furtively, you know, if they find your movement suspicious, they can justify stopping you.
That's the cause for this.
This is like the guy in Texas or something that looked at or was a woman that made eye contact with an officer and got pulled over for making eye contact or something.
Yeah, I mean, furtive movements, I mean, one of the interesting things about it is that it's anything, right? So there's nothing that cannot be a furtive movement. and you know, well, there are other reasons that you might have to prove X or Y. Furtive movement is if the officer says that it was the furtive movement, then it can count, whether it's the way you look or the way you move or where you are.
Right. So anything can be suspicious to anyone.
Is it suspicious to reacting to seeing a police officer in particular? Is that what a furtive movement, or is just a movement that could be suspicious?
I think just a movement that could be suspicious.
It's one of the most common reasons given for the stop. So and it doesn't need any more justification. So that's part of why it's been an interesting term for us, but also it's come up in a lot of people's writing about stop and frisk, because there's no, It is the catch-all when there's no other reason.
It's the most common but least defined.
Right. Exactly.
Do you hope that this kind of project is going to spark some sort of reform or a dialogue about what's going on? Or do you think about what the reaction to your projects are?
We do think about the reaction. I mean, you know, the projects for us in some way are a way of us processing the same kind of information that everyone else is dealing with. So, you know, the whole country is dealing with it, but in some ways this is, you know, our way of processing.
I would say that, you know, my first thought is how can we feel it? How can we understand it in a way beyond, you know, the numbers that kind of lose us when we look at them on the page? And, you know, and ultimately I think if we can feel it, then we can have a further dialogue, we can have reform. But I would say the purpose for me of the work is to feel and, you know, have a new way of perceiving.
And we should say that, you know, stop and frisk, you know, has already been pulled back in New York. Mm-hmm. But one reason that we want to talk about it now is that obviously this has been a model for the rest of the country. And so we see these patterns nationally. So even though it's on the decline in New York, and we see stop and frisk has gone down, as well as the crime rate. So the fact that police are doing fewer stops has not made crime increase in New York. And we think that's kind of interesting. But that kind of policing has been replicated all over the country. So it's still a national problem, even while the practice is on the decline in New York City.
And I guess, like you said before, you've set up a kind of a format that you can address other issues too. Even if this particular issue gets addressed, the lynchings you're talking about doing. What other projects might be included in the? What other numbers are you thinking about looking into?
So we're sort of working back through time. So this project is dealing with sort of police interactions with citizens, and then we're going back to the turn of the last century and looking at lynching statistics. And then after that, we're going to look at slave ship manifests, records from slave ship manifests in ports around America. Mm-hmm. But all of those things will be sort of micro radio station broadcasts where we deal with these numbers. And we're really looking at how America has used databases and violence. And we're making sounds from those so we can feel these records.
All right. Again, we're talking to Mendy and Keith Obadiki about their show Number Station, Furtive Movements. That's September 10th through October 10th at the Ryan Lee Gallery in New York.
So, yeah, that's it for Number Station. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.